Greetings, everyone, and welcome to the Law Hour and Editorial Review. The Law Hour is sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is an educational service in the public interest. I'm your narrator, George Gordon. The Law Hour and Editorial Review is heard nationally on 29 AM and FM radio stations 7 days a week here in the United States and in more than 70 countries worldwide on the Internet. For more information about the Law Hour and the Editorial Review, please visit my webpage, that's georgegordon.org. The Law Hour and Editorial Review brings you important information about law news and current events, so stay tuned for tonight's special report on lies that my teacher told me right after this. You know, 3,300 years ago, Moses instructed our founding fathers, "You shall not have in your bag diverse weights, a great and a small. You shall not have in your house diverse measures, a great and a small, but you shall have a perfect and a just weight, a perfect and a just measure shall you have." Well, our founding fathers at the Constitutional Convention in 1787 followed this scriptural law when they put, "No state shall make anything but gold or silver coin a tender in payment of debts," into our Constitution at Article 1, Section 10. But in 1933, Franklin D. Roosevelt took our gold away, and in 1964, President Johnson took silver coin out of circulation. And in place of just weights and balances, these two presidents introduced our current practice of the first, second, and fifth planks of the Communist Manifesto into our monetary system, and they gave us Federal Reserve notes in place of gold-backed treasury bills and clad coinage in place of silver coins. Now, in the intervening 70 years or so, we Americans have gone from being the world's number one creditor nation until today we are now the world's number one debtor nation. Now, who do you think were the better financial planners for our nation? Moses and our founding fathers, or Franklin Roosevelt and Lyndon Baines Johnson? To learn more about hard money and how to use it properly, it's another of the many lessons in my business school. Now, if you'd like to learn more, why don't you call and order my free General Law CD package? That's a 4-hour commentary on the law in general. Remember, it's educational, informative, it's entertaining. Best of all, it's free. You can call right now to order yours, the number 417-273-4967. The Business School is also available on compact disc for adult home study. If you're online, you can go to the website, georgegordon.org, click onto the email machine, and send an email request to order your free General Law CD package. Remember, that's georgegordon.org, or call direct, 417-273-4967. Lies my teacher told me. We've been taking a look here at a number of historical anomalies. Well, really more than just anomalies. They're absolute out-and-out untruths. It's a fiction that we're taught in high school and college about our history. It's revisionist history, but it's official. It's not revisionist history from the point of view of we want to straighten out what's wrong. It's revisionist history written by the textbook producers who sell their textbooks to our high schools and colleges for the express purpose of deceiving us, or maybe better said, telling us what we want to hear. We accept these myths in our history because that's what we read in the books. It's what we have grown up all of our lives believing, and there's no need to change now, is there? Just for the sake of accuracy or truth, would you say? Well, some of us would like to know, well, what really happened? What was Columbus's real motive for setting sail to the West? And his real motive was profit and gain. Not that that's necessarily wrong, but that's not what our history books tell us. But that's the real, honest to God's truth. And then when they got here, instead of taking a look at the people that were already here as being equals, they looked at them as being substandard or subhuman and enslaved them, conquered them, and then stole their lands and stole their property, stole their gold, stole their chattels. put them into slavery. What would you think if somebody came across the Rio Grande River and conquered Texas and then subjugated it, imposed a foreign and alien government, religion, and economic system upon the people of Texas and said, well, you people are subhuman. Obviously, we're superior. We conquered you. Well, that's the way we white Europeans have been acting over the last 500 years. Now, maybe it's politically incorrect to say we white Europeans, but after all, that's what most of us are, white Europeans, and we came over here to the Americas, and we kind of took over, and it's something that we don't like to admit, and the thing that I don't quite understand is, it's like going to Iraq. I don't mind going to Iraq and stealing those Arabs' oil, do you? But why can't we be honest about it and just go over there and steal their oil and say, we're thieves, and we're here to steal your oil. We have superior technology, and we're just doing it because we can. That's what President Clinton said. His tryst with Monica Lewinsky, he said he did it just because he could. And besides that, not only can we take the Iraqis' oils away from them, we need it. We need it more than they do, don't we? I mean, after all, we have this modern technological society that we need to support, and we need cheap energy to do it, don't we? But it's politically incorrect to tell people the truth, and so we have to couch the theft of Iraqi oil in platitudes and high-sounding terms like, gee, we went over there to save those people from this monster dictator. How come we don't go to North Korea and save the Koreans from that monster dictator? Is it because there's no oil there? Or is it because the monster dictator in Iraq was a worse monster dictator than the dictator in North Korea? Huh? Now there's word that we want to attack and destabilize Iran because they're about ready to come up with a nuclear weapon. Now, Pakistan's got a nuclear weapon. Do we really want the Iranians to have a nuclear weapon? And didn't we want to take Saddam Hussein out because he allegedly had weapons of mass destruction? Well, when the Iranians develop a bomb, won't they then have weapons of mass destruction? And what I don't quite understand is, why is it all right for America, Britain, and France to have atomic weapons, but Iraqis, Iranians, and Palestinians and North Koreans, they can't have nuclear weapons? Well, we're finding out why. Because, you see, if white Europeans are going to maintain their control of the world, we have to have superior military technology. We can't have China, Japan, and North Korea at a weapons parity with those of us in the West. And that's what really gave Europe the edge in conquering the world. And American history textbooks promote the belief that most important developments in world history are traceable to Europe. To grant too much human potential to pre-Columbian Africans might jar European-American sensibilities. As Samuel Marble put it, the possibility of African discovery of America has never been a tempting one for American historians. Teachers and curricula that present African history and African Americans in a positive light are often condemned for being Afrocentric. White historians insist that the case for the Afro-Phoenicians has not been proven. We must not distort history to improve black children's self-image, they say. Well, then, is it all right for us to distort history so that white children's self-image can be advanced? Well, they're right that the case hasn't been proven, but textbooks should include the Afro-Phoenicians as a possibility, at least a controversy, don't you think? Standard history textbooks and courses discriminate against students who have been educated by rap songs or by Von Sertima. Imagine an 11th grade classroom in American history. The text is Life and Liberty. Students are reading Chapter 2, Exploration and Colonization. What happens when an African-American girl shoots up her hand to challenge the statement that says, not until 1497 did the Portuguese explorer Vasco da Gama sail around Africa? From rap songs, the girl has learned that Afro-Phoenicians beat da Gama by more than 2,000 years. Does the teacher take time to research the question and find that the student is right and the textbook is wrong? More likely, she puts down the student's knowledge by saying rap songs aren't appropriate in history class, or she humors the child and says, yes, but that was a long time ago and it didn't lead to anything. Let me ask this. If it happened 2,000 years ago, how do we know that it didn't lead to anything? What history do you have that would indicate that it didn't lead to anything? Now, Vasco da Gama's discovery is the important one. That's what the history teacher will say. These responses allow the class to move forward to the next topic. If that doesn't work, then the teacher will ridicule and impugn the child and put her down in front of her classmates. Ridicule is the way you stop intellectual debate. They also contain some truth. You see, the Afro-Phoenician circumnavigation didn't lead to any new trade routes or national alliances because the Afro-Phoenicians were already trading with India through the Red Sea and the Persian Gulf. Textbooks don't name Vasco da Gama because something came from his discovery, however. They name him because he's white. Two pages later, Life and Liberty tells us that Hernando de Soto discovered the Mississippi River. Of course, it had been discovered and named the Mississippi River by ancestors of the Indians who were soon to chase de Soto down that river naked. And textbooks portray de Soto in armor, not showing that by the time he reached the river, his men and women had lost all of their clothing in a fire set by the Indians in Alabama and were wearing replacement clothes woven from reeds. De Soto's discovery had no larger significance and led to no trade and led to no white settlements. His was merely the first white face to gaze upon the Mississippi River. Well, at least the first white face since the last white face some millennia before De Soto arrived. And that's why 10 of the 12 American history textbooks exclude him. From Eric the Red to Perry at the North Pole to the first man on the moon, we celebrate most discoverers because they were the first to do what they did, and because they were white, not because of events that flowed or did not flow from their accomplishments or any trade routes or establishments or colonies that they might have accomplished. Now, my hypothetical teacher subtly changed the ground rules for da Gama, but they changed right back for De Soto. You see, in this way, students learn that black feats are not considered important while white feats are. Now, continuing down the list of likely pre-Columbian exploration, we arrive at an interesting vantage point from which to consider this debate. Let us compare two other possible pre-Columbian expeditions from the west coasts of Africa and Ireland. When Columbus reached Haiti, he found the Arawaks, A-R-A-W-A-K-S, in possession of some spear points made of guanine. G-U-A-N-I-N-E, guanine. The Indians said they got them from black traders who had come from the south and east. Guanine proved to be an alloy of gold, silver, and copper, identical to the gold alloy preferred by West Africans who also called it guanine, G-U-A-N-I-N-E. Now, Islamic historians have recorded stories of voyages west from Mali in West Africa around 1311 during the reign of Mansa Bakari II. From time to time in the 14th and 15th centuries, shipwrecked African vessels, remnants, presumably of transatlantic trade, washed up on Cape Verde. From contacts in West Africa, the Portuguese heard that African traders were visiting Brazil in the mid-1400s. This knowledge may have influenced Portugal to insist on moving the Pope's line of demarcation further west in the Treaty of Tordesillas in 1494. Traces of diseases common in Africa have been detected in pre-Columbian corpses in Brazil. And Columbus's son, Ferdinand, who accompanied the admiral on his third voyage, reports that people they met or heard about in eastern Honduras were almost black in color, ugly in aspect, probably Africans. The first Europeans to reach Panama, Balboa and company, reported seeing black slaves in an Indian town. The Indians said that they had captured them from a nearby black community. Oral history from Afro-Mexicans contains tales of pre-Columbian crossings from West Africa. In all, then, data from diverse sources suggest that pre-Columbian voyages from West Africa to America were probable. In contrast, the evidence for an Irish trip to America comes from only one side of the Atlantic. Irish legends written in the 9th or 10th century tell of an abbot and 17 monks who journeyed to the promised land of the saints during a 7-year adventure in a leather boat. The stories include details that are literally fabulous. Each Easter, the priest and his crew supposedly conducted mass on the back of a whale. They visited a pillar of crystal, perhaps an iceberg, and an island of fire. We cannot simply dismiss these legends, however, when the Norse first reached Iceland. Irish repeats this hoax. The superstitious sailors grew increasingly mutinous, according to Pageant. Now, the monks were living on the island whose volcanoes could have provided the island of fire. How do American history textbooks treat these two sets of legendary voyagers? Well, 5 of the textbooks admit the possibility of an Irish expedition. The Challenge of Freedom book gives the fullest account. One paragraph. It says, some people believe that Irish missionaries may have sailed to the Americas hundreds of years before the first voyages of Columbus. According to Irish legends, Irish monks sailed the Atlantic Ocean in order to bring Christianity to the people they met. One Irish legend in particular tells about a land southwest of the Azores. This land was supposedly discovered by St. Brendan, an Irish missionary, about 500 AD. Not one textbook mentions the West Africans, however. While leaving out Columbus's predecessors, American history books continue to make mistakes, especially when they get to the last discoverer. They present cut-and-dried answers, mostly glorifying Columbus, always avoiding uncertainty or controversy. Often, their errors seem to be copied from other textbooks. Let me repeat the collective Columbus story they tell, this time italicizing everything in it that we have solid reason to believe is true. Now, here's the story from the textbooks. It says, born in Genoa of humble parents, Christopher Columbus grew up to become an experienced seafarer, venturing as far as Iceland and West Africa. His adventures convinced him that the world must be round and that the fabled riches of the East, spices and gold, could be had by sailing west, superseding the overland routes which the Turks had closed off to commerce. To get funding for his enterprise, he beseeched monarch after monarch in Western Europe. After at first being dismissed by Ferdinand and Isabella of Spain, Columbus finally got his chance when Isabella decided to underwrite a modest expedition. Columbus outfitted 3 pitifully small ships, the Nina, the Pinta, and the Santa Maria, and set forth from Spain. After an arduous journey of more than 2 months, during which his mutinous crew almost threw him overboard. Columbus discovered the West Indies on October 12, 1492. Unfortunately, although he made three more voyages to America, he never knew he had discovered a new world. Columbus died in obscurity, unappreciated and penniless. Yet without his daring, American history would have been very different. For in a sense, he made it all possible. Now there's the quotation from the history textbook. Now as you can see, the textbooks get the date right. And the names of the ships, most of the rest that they tell us is untrustworthy. Many aspects of Columbus's life remain a mystery. He claimed to be from Genoa, Italy, and there is evidence that he was. There is also evidence that he wasn't. Columbus didn't seem to be able to write in Italian, even when writing to people in Genoa. Some historians believe he was Jewish, a conservo or convert to Christianity, probably from Spain. Spain was pressuring its Jews to convert to Christianity or leave the country. He may have been a Genoese Jew. Still other historians claim he was from Corsica, Portugal, or elsewhere. Why all of this controversy? What about Columbus's social class background? Well, one textbook tells us that he was poor, the son of a poor Genoese weaver, while another assures us that he was rich, the son of a prosperous wool weaver. Each of these texts is certain, but people who have spent years studying Columbus say we cannot be sure. We do not even know for certain where Columbus thought he was going. Evidence suggests that he was seeking Japan, India, and Indonesia. Other evidence indicates that he was trying to reach new lands to the west. Historians have asserted each viewpoint for centuries. Because India was known for its great wealth, Las Casas points out that it was in Columbus's interest to induce the monarchs, always doubtful about his enterprise, to believe him when he said he was setting out in search of a western route to India. After reviewing the evidence, Columbus's recent biographer, Kirkpatrick Sale, concluded, "We will likely never know for sure." Sale noted that such a conclusion is not very satisfactory for those who demand certainty in their historical tales. Predictably, all of our textbooks are of this type. All know that he was seeking Japan and the East Indies. Thus, authors keep their readers from realizing that historians do not know all the answers. Hence, history is not just a process of memorizing them. The extent to which textbooks sometimes disagree, particularly when each seems so certain of what it declares, can be pretty scary. What was the weather like during Columbus's 1492 trip? Well, according to Land of Promise, his ships were storm-battered. But in the textbook American Adventures, it says that they enjoyed peaceful seas. How long was the voyage? Well, after more than 2 months at sea, according to the Challenge of Freedom, the crews saw land, but the American Adventure says the voyage lasted nearly a month. What were the Americas like when Columbus arrived? Thickly populated, or thickly peopled in one book, quoting Columbus. Thinly spread, according to another. Well, which was it? Were the islands thickly populated or sparsely populated? Did the voyage take 1 month or 2 months? And was the weather bad or was the weather good? Now, to make a better myth, American culture has perpetuated the idea that Columbus was boldly forging ahead while everyone else, even his own crew, imagined the world was flat. The American Pageant is the only textbook that still repeats this hoax. The superstitious sailors grew increasingly mutinous, according to Pageant, because they were fearful of sailing over the edge of the world. In truth, very few people on both sides of the Atlantic believed in 1492 that the world was flat. Most Europeans and Native Americans knew the world to be round. It looks round. It casts a circular shadow on the moon. Sailors see its roundness when ships disappear over the horizon, hull first, then sails. Washington Irving wins credit for popularizing the flat earth fable in 1828 in his best-selling biography of Columbus. Irving described Columbus's supposed defense of his round earth theory before the flat earth savants at Salamanca University. It was Washington Irving himself who surely knew the story to be a fiction. He probably thought it added a nice dramatic flourish and would do no harm. But it does. It invites us to believe that the primitives of the world, admittedly including pre-Columbian Europeans, had only a crude understanding of the planet that they lived on, until aided by a forward-thinking European. A forward-thinking white European at that. And it also turns Columbus into a man of science who corrected our faulty geography. But this totally ignores the geography of the pre-Columbians, people who had maps that were in the museums, the Arabs, and the Muslims who had maps of the world, even of North and South America and Antarctica, and who had been sailing around Africa as early as 1000 BC, that we know of. And we have artifacts from the 1000 BC to 0 AD period all over North and South America, as we have just uncovered huge 10 to 30 ton stones in Mexico with Negroid and white Caucasian features inscribed on them. And furthermore, the Americas were populated, both North and South America, when Columbus and all of the Spaniards got over here. Huge civilizations were already in place, the Aztec civilization, the Maya civilization, and we have these huge pyramids in Mexico City, or outside Mexico City, 40 miles, the Pyramid of the Sun and the Pyramid of the Moon, which are built exactly like the pyramids of Egypt. Is it just a coincidence that the Aztecs and the Incas, the Mayans, and the other ancient civilizations were building pyramids over here in the New World with the same architectural design as those in Egypt, and the people on this side had never had any contact with the people over in the Middle East? Where did they get the idea that a pyramid should be built like the Pyramid of the Moon and the Pyramid of the Sun? Or the other pyramids that are built in Central and South America that are built like the pyramids in Iraq and Iran. Step pyramids. You know, boys and girls, what we have been taught, what we have been told by our teachers, is a long ways from the truth. And it gives all of us a hazy, if not a fundamentally warped view of ancient man. We see ancient man as being a Neanderthal dragging his knuckles on the ground, when in fact the Bible clearly tells us that these people were artificers in brass and iron right out of the Garden of Eden, and that they were keepers of cattle, and that they were engaged in agriculture, and that they were building cities, if you can believe it. Well, we got to take a break here, so we'll take a quick break and we'll be right back with more on the lies that our teacher told us right after this. All right, you're listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Civil Rights Act of 1868 was enacted by Congress to be the citizen's policeman against police and government abuse. Randy Weaver was paid over $1 million for the wrongful deaths of his wife and son. Right now, the police in Los Angeles are bracing for hundreds of civil rights lawsuits in its latest round of Rodney King-style police misconduct. You know, we hear a lot through radio, TV, and the press when these sensational government-citizen confrontations are being acted out. But then we hear little or nothing about the government paying for these abuses under the Civil Rights Act, called Title 42, Section 1983. Now, what would you do if you were victimized by the FBI, the IRS, or some other governmental agency who takes your property, arrests you, jails you, or beats you? There is a remedy for every wrong if you know how to achieve it. Now, there are more than 14 million of these civil rights crimes committed by police and government officials at every level of our government, and they do it every year. So whether you've been a victim or you think that you may be a victim of government wrongdoing, why don't you call and order my free general law CD package? That's a four-hour commentary on the law in general. It's educational, it's informative, it's entertaining. Best of all, it's free of charge, and you can call right now and order yours. The number's 417-273-4967. Now, if you're online, go to the website georgegordon.org, click onto the email, and send an email request for that free general law CD package. That's georgegordon.org, or call direct 417-273-4967. All right, we're reviewing a book called Lies My Teacher Told Me, written by James Loewen, L-O-E-W-E-N, published by the New York Press, copyright 1995. It's a dynamite book. It's about, I don't know, 400 pages or so. Let me see here, 302, probably about 350 pages. Easy reading, and just filled with, probably 100 of these pseudo-historical lies. Lies that our teacher told us, probably because the teacher believed the lies himself or herself. I went through the high school experience. I believed what the textbook told me. I remember in the 10th grade, we went into ancient history, and my history teacher, Mr. Shalinas, he said to the class, we're going to start on ancient history. We're going to find out where it all began. So I looked at the beginning of the book, and it began with Nebuchadnezzar, about 700 B.C. You know, even in the 10th grade, I knew that there was history before Nebuchadnezzar. You know, I'd been to Sunday school a couple of times, and I heard about the Garden of Eden. What I wanted in school, I wanted to go back to the Garden of Eden. What happened between the Garden of Eden and Nebuchadnezzar? And I asked the question in the class, and the teacher, Shalinas, was really upset with me. He said, Gordon, this class starts with Nebuchadnezzar, the textbook starts with Nebuchadnezzar, and you're going to start with Nebuchadnezzar. That's ancient history. Well, like Galileo, you know, I said, okay, maybe that's where we're going to start, but that isn't where ancient history begins. And from that point on in my life, I decided that probably what I was learning was a combination of lies and truth. And that's where life really is. That's where deception is. You see, to deceive you, we have to tell you the truth. If we lied to you all the time, you'd always know the truth. So if we told you the truth all the time, you'd know the truth. So to deceive you, we have to tell you the truth and mix it with lies. Intense debunking of the flat earth legend by professional historians has made an impact. Yet even the 11 textbooks that do not repeat Irving's fiction chose wholly ineffectual words to counter it. Listen to this passage from Triumph of the American Nation exemplifies the problem. It says, convinced that the earth was round, a knowledge shared by many informed people of the day, Columbus believed that if he sailed far enough to the west, he would reach Asia. To be sure, the minor subordinate clause quietly notes that not everyone, perhaps not even most people, believed in flat earth geography. But the main subordinate clause and the primary clause emphasize Columbus's own belief that the earth was round. The sentence makes little sense unless the reader infers that Columbus's belief was unusual. Now, I've talked not only with students, but also with teachers who have read textbooks like Triumph without noticing this point. Thus, teachers often still believe and still relay to their students the flat earth legend. Even the death of Columbus has been changed to make a better story. Having Columbus come to a tragic end, a sick, poor, and ignorant of his great accomplishment, adds melodramatic interest. Columbus's discoveries were not immediately appreciated by the Spanish government, according to the American Adventure. He died in neglect in 1506. Well, in fact, Spain immediately appreciated Columbus's discoveries, which is why they immediately outfitted him for a second, much larger second voyage. In 1499, Columbus made a major gold strike on Haiti. He and his successors then forced hundreds of thousands of Indians to mine the gold for them. Money from the Americas continued to flow into Columbus in Spain. Perhaps not what he felt he deserved, but certainly enough to keep all of the wolves far away from his door. Columbus died well off and left his heirs well endowed, even with the title Admiral of the Ocean Sea, now carried by his 18th generation descendant. Moreover, Columbus's own journal shows clearly that he knew that he had reached a new continent. The errors textbooks make about Columbus do not result simply from sloppy scholarship either. Textbooks want to magnify Columbus as a great hero, a man of vision, energy, resourcefulness, and courage. In the words of the American pageant, some of the details that the textbook authors pile on are harmless, I suppose, such as the fabrications about Isabella sending a messenger galloping after Columbus and pawning her jewels to pay for the expedition. All of the enhancements humanize Columbus, however, to induce readers to identify with him. Here's the passage from The Land of Promise. It says, "It is October 1492. Three small storm-battered ships are lost at sea, sailing into an unknown ocean. A frightened crew has been threatening to throw their stubborn captain overboard, turn the ships around, and make for the safety of familiar shores. Then a miracle. The sailors see some green branches floating on the water. Land birds fly overhead. From high in the ship's rigging, the lookout cries, 'Land, land ahead!' Fears turn to joy, and soon the grateful captain wades ashore and gives thanks to God." Now really, the Nina, the Pinta, and the Santa Maria were not storm-battered. To make a better myth, the textbook authors want the voyage to seem harder than it really was. So they invent bad weather. Columbus's own journal reveals that the three ships enjoyed lovely sailing the whole way. Seas were so calm that for days at a time sailors were able to converse from one ship to another. Indeed, the only time they experienced even moderately high seas was on the last day when they knew they were near land. To make a better myth, to make the trip seem longer than it was, most of the textbooks overlook Columbus's stopover in the Canary Islands. The voyage across the unknown Atlantic took 1 month, not 2 months. To make a better myth, the textbooks describe Columbus's ships as tiny and inefficient, when actually these three vessels were fully suited to this purpose. As naval author Pietro Barrazzoli has pointed out, "To make a better myth, 6 of 12 textbooks exaggerate the crew's complaints into a near mutiny. The primary sources differ. Some claim the sailors threatened to go back home if they didn't reach land soon. Other sources claim that Columbus lost heart and that the captains of the other two ships persuaded him to keep on. Still other sources suggest that the three leaders met and agreed to continue on for a few more days and then reassess the situation. After studying the matter, Columbus's biographer, Samuel Eliot Morison, reduced the complaints to mere griping. They were all getting on each other's nerves, as happens now, even nowadays. So much for the crew's threat to throw Columbus overboard. Now, such exaggeration is not entirely harmless. Another archetype lurks below the surface. That those who direct social enterprises are more intelligent than those nearer the bottom. Bill Bigelow, a high school history teacher, has pointed out that the sailors are stupid, superstitious, cowardly, and sometimes scheming. Columbus, on the other hand, is brave, wise, and godlike. Now, these portrayals amount to an anti-working class, pro-boss polemic. Indeed, the only textbook that still repeats the old flat earth myth thinks badly of the sailors, whom it characterizes as a motley crew. False entries in the log of the Santa Maria constitute another piece of the myth. Columbus was a true leader, says A History of the United States. He altered the records of distance they had covered so the crew would not think they had gone too far from home. Salvador de Magaraga has persuasively argued that to believe this, we would have to think the others on the voyage were all total fools. Columbus had no special method available only to him whereby distances sailed could be more accurately reckoned than by the other pilots and masters of the other ships. Indeed, Columbus was less experienced as a navigator than the Pinzon brothers who captained the Nina and the Pinta. During the return voyage, Columbus confided in his journal the real reason for the false log entries. He wanted to keep the route to the Indies secret, as paraphrased by Las Casas. He says that he pretended to have gone a greater distance in order to confound the pilots and the sailors who did the charts that he might remain master of that route to the Indies. Now, to make a better myth, our textbooks find space for many other humanizing particulars. They have the lookout cry, tierra, or land. Most of them tell us that Columbus's first act after going ashore was thanking God for leading them safely across the sea, even though the surviving summary of Columbus's own journal states only that before them all he took possession of the island, as in fact he did, for the king and queen, his sovereigns. Many of the textbooks tell of Columbus's three later voyages to the Americas, but they do not find space to tell us how Columbus treated the lands and the people that he discovered. Christopher Columbus introduced two phenomena that revolutionized race relations and transformed the modern world: the taking of land, wealth, and labor from the indigenous peoples, leading to their near extermination, and the transatlantic slave trade, which created a racial underclass. Now, that's not the story that you and I received when we went to school, now, is it? That's certainly not the story that I heard. I never heard anything about Columbus creating a racial underclass, or that he came over here and claimed these lands and stole them from the natives. Pretty presumptuous of him, wasn't it, to walk over here, step off the ship, and say, "I claim this land in the name of my sovereign." What about the people that already lived here? Didn't they have a right to that land? Didn't they have a right to their gold? I thought Columbus was a trader, not a conqueror, didn't you? Hang on, we'll be right back. All right, we're back. You're listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Back in the 1970s, an obscure black college professor at Tuskegee Institute in Alabama, working on a grant, developed a unique marketing plan for agricultural products. The plan was aimed at poor, rural black landowners in the South who owned small acreages. The goal was to keep these landowners on the land by producing produce for sale to the public at retail and to generate an income that would support a family. The Whatley program was so successful that it became known as the Whatley program, how to make $100,000 per year on 25 acres or less. That was Professor Booker T. Whatley. Not a million, but 100,000 is pretty good. Now there are more than 4,000 of these small family enterprises operating all over the United States. Now, the law school has taken the Whatley program and added the 15 agricultural laws of the Bible and the 17 financial laws from Scripture so that you can practice all of these laws of the Scripture and all of the laws of the United States, your state, and make a good living for you and your family at the same time. Now, if you'd like to learn more about this program, why don't you call and order my free general law CD package? It's a 4-hour commentary on the law in general. It's educational, it's informative, it's entertaining. Best of all, it's free of charge, and you can call and order yours right now. The number to call, 417-273-4967. And my $100,000 class is also available on compact disc for adult home study. If you're online, you can go to the website, georgegordon.org. Click onto the email. Send me an email request for that free general law CD package. That's georgegordon.org. Or call direct, 417-273-4967. All right, we're reviewing the book, Lies My Teacher Told Me, written by James Loewen. That's spelled L-O-E-W-E-N. You can get a copy probably at Barnes & Noble or any bookstore. Published by New York Press, copyrighted 1995, a dynamite book, about 350 pages, Lies My Teacher Told Me. I didn't rate this one as a 1 in 20. I've read other books along this line. Typically, they're kind of humorous. They just take little short pieces and point out that that's an error, or that isn't true, or that's the wrong date, or something like that. But this book is a more in-depth, scholarly publication to identify the harms that come from these incessant lies that all of us have been taught and trained, because it gives us a skewered view of the world. We do not see the world the way it really is. We see ourselves in Iraq as being, you know, good-hearted Americans, gum-chewing, camera-toting Americans, just over here trying to help the poor people in Iraq throw off this tyranny. The truth of the matter is we're over there to steal their oil. And the fact that Saddam Hussein was a bad guy just plays into our hands. There are other bad guys in the world. There are bad guys in control of Iran right next door, and you don't see us over there. There are bad guys in North Korea, and we're not there. And now we're taking a look at Columbus. Now, Columbus has always been pictured as a great hero. And I guess if you're a white Anglo-Saxon and you're the beneficiaries of the thefts, I guess he's a great guy. But as we find more about Columbus, we find he was a real scallywag. This guy is a slave trader. This guy, Columbus, kills people by the tens of thousands, as we're going to see here as we progress along. And he's killing Native Americans probably from the point of view that, after all, they're just a bunch of pagans. And after all, we're Christians. And these pagans need to die. Well, they need to work in the gold mines first and produce a lot of wealth for us before they die. But if they die in the process, it's all right. Well, listen to this. Columbus's initial impression of the Arawaks, who inhabited most of the islands in the Caribbean, was quite favorable. He wrote in his journal on October the 13th, 1492, "At daybreak, great multitudes of men came to the shore, all young and of fine shapes, and very handsome. Their hair was not curly, but loose and coarse, like horsehair. All have foreheads much broader than any people I had hitherto seen. Their eyes are large and very beautiful, and they're not black, but the color of the inhabitants of the Canaries." This reference to the Canary Islands is very ominous, for Spain was then in the process of exterminating the aboriginal people of the Canary Islands. Columbus went on to describe the Arawak's canoes, some large enough to contain 40 or 45 men. Finally, he got down to business. I was very attentive to them and strove to learn if they had any gold. Seeing some of them with little bits of metal hanging on their noses, I gathered from them by signs that by going southward or steering around the island in that direction, there would be found a king who possessed great cups full of gold. At dawn the next day, Columbus sailed to the other side of the island, probably one of the Bahamas, and saw two or three villages. He ended his description of them with these menacing words, quote, "I could conquer the whole of them with 50 men and govern them as I pleased," unquote. Now that's Columbus. On his first voyage, Columbus kidnapped 25 Indians and took them back with him to Spain. Only seven of the Indians arrived alive, but along with the parrots, gold trinkets, and other exotica, they caused quite a stir in Seville, Spain. Ferdinand and Isabella provided Columbus with 17 ships, 1,200 men, cannons, crossbows, guns, cavalry, and attack dogs for the second voyage. One way to visualize what happened next is with the help of the famous science fiction story, War of the Worlds, by H.G. Wells. Intended his tale of Earthlings' encounter with technologically advanced aliens as an allegory. His frightened British commoners, New Jerseyites in Orson Welles' radio adaptation, were analogous to the primitive peoples of the Canaries or of America, and his terrifying aliens represented the technologically advanced Europeans. And as we identify with the helpless Earthlings, Welles wanted us also to sympathize with the natives of Haiti in 1493, or of Australia in 1788, or in the upper Amazon jungle in the 1990s. When Columbus and his men returned to Haiti in 1493, they demanded food, gold, spun cotton, and whatever else the Indians had that they wanted, including sex with their women. To ensure cooperation, Columbus used punishment by example. When an Indian committed even a minor offense, the Spanish cut off his ears or nose. Disfigured, the person was sent back to his village as living evidence of the brutality that the Spaniards were capable of. After a while, the Indians had had enough. At first, their resistance was mostly passive. They refused to plant food for the Spanish to take. They abandoned towns near the Spanish settlements. Finally, the Arawaks fought back. Their sticks and stones were no more effective against the armed and clothed Spanish, however, than the Earthlings' rifles against the aliens' death rays in War of the Worlds. The attempts at resistance gave Columbus an excuse to make war. On March 24, 1495, he set out to conquer the Arawaks. Bartolomé de las Casas described the force Columbus assembled to put down the rebellion. Since the admiral perceived that daily the people of the land were taking up arms, ridiculous weapons in reality, he hastened to proceed to the country and disperse and subdue by force of arms the people of the entire island. For this he chose 200 foot soldiers and 20 cavalry, with many crossbows and small cannon, lances and swords, and a still more terrible weapon against the Indians, in addition to the horses. This was 20 hunting dogs, who were turned loose and immediately tore the Indians apart. Naturally, the Spanish won the war, and according to Kirkpatrick Sale, who quotes Ferdinand, Columbus's biography of his father, the soldiers mowed down dozens with point-blank volleys, loosed the dogs to rip open limbs and bellies, chased the fleeing Indians into the bush to skewer them on sword and pike, and with God's aid soon gained a complete victory, killing many Indians and capturing others who were also killed. Having as yet found no fields of gold, Columbus had to return some kind of dividend to Spain. So in 1495, the Spanish on Haiti initiated a great slave raid, and they rounded up 1,500 Arawaks and then selected the 500 best specimens, of whom 200 would die en route to Spain. Another 500 were chosen as slaves for the Spaniards staying on the island. The rest were released. A Spanish eyewitness described the event like this, quote, "Among them were many women who had infants at the breast. They, in turn, in order the better to escape us, since they were afraid that we would turn to catch them again, left their infants anywhere on the ground and started to flee like desperate people, and some fled as far that they were removed from our settlement of Isabella 7 or 8 days beyond mountains and across huge rivers. Wherefore, from now on, scarcely any will be had." Well, Columbus was excited. "In the name of the Holy Trinity, we can send from here all the slaves in Brazil wood which could be sold." He wrote to Ferdinand and Isabella in 1496, "In Castile, Portugal, Aragon, and the Canary Islands, they need many slaves, and I do not think they get enough from Guinea." He viewed the Indian death rate optimistically. "Although they die now, they will not always die. The Negroes and Canary Islanders died at first." Well, in the words of Hans Koning, "There now began a reign of terror in Hispaniola. Spaniards hunted Indians for sport and murdered them for dog food. Columbus, upset because he could not locate the gold that he was certain was on the island, set up a tribute system." Ferdinand Columbus described how it worked. "The Indians all promised to pay tribute to the Catholic sovereigns every 3 months as follows. In the Cibo, where the mines were, every person of 14 years of age or upward was to pay a large hawk's bell of gold dust. All others were to pay 25 pounds of cotton. Whenever an Indian delivered his tribute, he was to receive a brass or copper token, which he must wear about his neck as proof that he had made his payment. Any Indian found without such a token was to be punished. With a fresh token, an Indian was safe for 3 months, much of which time would be devoted to collecting more gold. Columbus's son neglected to mention how the Spanish punished those whose tokens had expired. They cut off their hands." Well, now, that isn't what I heard about Columbus. Was it what you heard? Again, it probably was a necessity. I mean, after all, we Europeans needed to come over here and kill off all of the indigenous people over here and steal their land and steal their gold, didn't we? And after all, it's nothing personal. It's just business. It's the white man's business. War is the white man's business. It always has been. We're a very warlike people. You take a look at the Vikings. We're a very warlike people. The Europeans have been fighting, the Christian Europeans have been fighting among themselves for thousands of years. Look at the Irish, the Scots, and the English, fighting wars with the French. The Hundred Years' War. I mean, we measure our wars in decades and in hundreds of years. All right, we're about out of time. We'll see you back here tomorrow night, same time, same station. You've been listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Now, the law school conducts a homeschooling program for adults in compact disc. For more information, just go to the homeschooling page on the website, georgegordon.org. The Law Hour is carried worldwide on the Internet. All of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date. The Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. Well, there's the signal. It says my time is up. I got to leave it right here. We'll be back tomorrow night, same time, same station. God willing, of course, with more on Columbus and lies my teacher told me next time. Good night, friends.